This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I've been listening to the beautiful music that Kate and Anna McGarrigle made together. The two sisters started recording in the mid-70s. They never became as famous as their song Heart Like a Wheel, which was a big hit for Linda Ronstadt in 1974. But the McGarrigles had a devoted following in the U.S. and in Canada, where they're from. Kate died a year and a half ago of sarcoma. Two tribute concerts are scheduled for this week, featuring such performers as Nora Jones, Jimmy Fallon, Emmylou Harris, Teddy Thompson, Anna McGarrigle, and Kate's children, Martha and Rufus Wainwright. A new 3-CD set has been released called Tell My Sister. It collects the McGarrigles' early demo recordings, as well as their first two albums, their self-titled 1976 debut and their 1977 follow-up, Dancer with Bruised Knees. They cover a period when Kate was married to Loudon Wainwright and gave birth to Rufus. My guest, Anna McGarrigle, is going to talk with us about Kate and the songs they recorded together. Let's start with the demo version of Heart Like a Wheel, which was written by Anna. Anna McGarrigle, welcome back to Fresh Air, and I'm so sorry about your sister, and I'm so glad that these albums have been reissued and that the demos are now available for us to hear. What's it been like for you to listen back to these sessions without her to listen to them with you?
Well, it took me a long time before I was able to listen to her singing at all, period. You know, this is after she died. It took me a few months, and then I had to do a lot of listening to things, and I just thought, well, I'm just going to grip my teeth and do this. But every now and then I'd hear her sing something, and I would just, you know, sometimes it would be so unexpected I wouldn't know why it was a particular song or the time of day or whatever. It was just, I'd break out in tears.
So the song that we just played, Heart Like a Wheel, was the first song that you ever wrote. And the liner notes make it seem that you would never have written that song if it weren't for your sister, Kate. And she was in New York at the time, becoming part of the folk scene there. You were in Montreal. I think you were in art school at the time?
Yes, I was just finishing up art school.
And so tell us how you were inspired to write a song because of Kate.
Well, the thing is, she and Roma Baron had gone down to the village to just to see what was happening. And they had worked out a lot of blues stuff at piano and guitar, and they were really fantastic. And there'll be later demos down the line that they did. But she called me and she said, hey, everybody down here is writing their own songs because Dylan, we knew, you know, we were big followers of Dylan. But when he came along, you know, it made it hard for anybody else to measure up to his talents. So people just didn't bother writing songs. You know, we were in folk groups and we'd always sing covers and covers of Dylan. But somehow by 1969, there were a lot of people who were out there just, you know, writing new kinds of, I guess you could call it new folk, because it wasn't really sort of traditional folk. And so when she told me that, I ran with the idea and sat down at the piano, which I never actually was able to get on, because in our house, a lot of people played the piano, and I was like the last one to get on it. But I had to wait for everybody to go away. And they were all gone, so I was able to play it.
So it's a great song. You know, if everybody could write such a great song as their first song, what a world it would be. But had anybody actually said to you, you know, that the heart is just like a wheel, when you bend it, it can't be mended? You know, because...
No, nobody had ever said that. But I think I was thinking about a bicycle. And it's true that once you've bent that wheel, you ain't ever going to roll right again. And that, I thought of the heart as being the same way. And at the time, I was having a bit of heartbreak, so...
Oh, do you want to tell us what happened?
No.
Okay, fair enough. So, and then eventually down the line, Linda Ronstadt ended up having a really big hit with this. It was the title track of a very popular album. So how did she get the song?
Well, Kate and Roma worked it up. They came back to Montreal, and I played it for them up in my mother's place in Saint-Sever. They did a really lovely version, and actually made a couple of demo tapes in studios in New York, because they were looking for a deal at the same time too. And anyway, so people heard the demos, and the story is that Jerry Jeff Walker had either heard them or heard a demo, and he played it for Linda Ronstadt.
And I guess she liked it.
Yes, she did, although she also used to say a lot of people thought it was a really awful song. I think what it is it's very... artless in a way, because I think Roma had pointed this out. I'm sort of changing metaphors in mid-ocean or whatever. But that didn't bother me, because I was just writing from the heart.
Right. In terms of changing metaphors, it's like the heart is like a wheel, and my heart
and
is on a
on
ship
the ocean.
Out in mid-ocean.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So it sounds like you hadn't necessarily thought seriously about a music career, about, you know, performing a lot when your sister was in New York looking for a recording deal. And it was only through accident, through a mistake, really, that you ended up recording with her.
Yes, because we used to sing backup in a folk group in Montreal. But by 1969, I was definitely not singing. And Kate and Roma, you know, had become a sort of duo. And then after Kate got married in 1971, and they moved to London, she and Loudon moved to London, she lost a baby, their marriage broke up temporarily, she came back to Montreal, and then sooner or later Rufus was born, and it was after that she wanted to do something in music, and at that point we already had three covers, I think, of our songs, so we weren't exactly chopped liver. People took it seriously because Maria Muldaur had recorded the work song, and then she did a song that I wrote with a friend called Cool River. And Heart Like a Wheel had just come out on Linda Ronstadt's record. So we were a known quantity at that point. She said to me, I don't want to do this by myself. And I wasn't really doing much of anything, so I said, sure.
So because she didn't want to perform by herself, you joined her?
Yes. I would never have done this on my own, never.
Why not? Did you not? Were you not interested in that kind of life, or did you not have faith in your voice? Or?
I didn't. For one thing, I wasn't a very good musician. I mean, I could sort of accompany myself badly, and I could sing, and I could harmonize easily enough. I mean, I didn't have an amazing voice, but I think together we sounded nice, and I think she convinced me that it would be. That it would be a good thing to do.
Well, you harmonize so beautifully together, and I thought I'd play something from the demo recordings that have just been released as part of the box Tell My Sister. And this is a traditional song that I guess you figured out your own arrangement for, And it's called Rose Blanche, White Roses. Yep. And before we hear it, tell us something about how you learned this song.
You know, I think that Kate may have sung this once, not really for a soundtrack for the National Film Board, but it was possibly something that they were thinking of using, because she had done a couple of soundtracky type things. And I think she and I knew the song because when we sang in this folk group in Montreal, we had two or three French songs in our repertoire, and that would have been one of them.
So who's singing the high part and who's singing the low part?
We switch.
Wow.
We switch back and forth, yeah.
Okay, well, these are two sisters harmonizing beautifully, and you'll be hearing Anna McGarrigle and her late sister, Kate McGarrigle, and this is from a demo that's on the new box set, Kate and Anna McGarrigle, Tell My Sister. Rose Blanche, sung by my guest Anna McGarrigle with her late sister Kate McGarrigle. And that's a demo recording from the very beginning of their career. And that's been released along with their first two albums in a new box set called Tell My Sister. And there's a memorial concert for Kate McGarrigle May 12th and 13th in New York. So as we could hear from that recording, you sound so much like sisters. Your voices, they sound so similar.
Yes, I think what it is you know, you find your place in the family. Kate was the youngest, I was the middle, and our sister Janie was the eldest. And the three of us actually sounded very nice together, as did, you know, Kate and I sounded nice together. And it's just you find your voice, you know, in more ways than one. You find the note, and you also find your, the way you're going to be.
Well, you were very close in age also. You were a year older.
We're 14 months apart. Yeah.
So were you and your sister competitive as singers, or did you enjoy singing together and feel like you were better together than individually?
You know, I think when we started out, we probably didn't think too much about it. Kate was definitely more competitive than I was. But I think that she also appreciated the fact that maybe I wasn't as competitive. I think if I had been very competitive, we probably wouldn't have worked very well together.
It sounds like Kate was more of the traveler, more of the adventurer.
Yeah, Kate was fearless. You know, I have no idea if I hadn't had a sister, a younger sister, would I have been different? I don't know. I have a feeling, you know, Kate was very, she was a hyperactive child, even though later on in life she was the kind of person that would sleep in and or fall asleep on the couch or something. Whereas I could never, as I got older, I became more nervous. So it's strange. We kind of switch places.
You mostly stayed in Montreal.
And yes, I did.
And she lived in several places and wrote about coming and going places. And I want to play one of her songs about leaving, and this is a song called Tell My Sister, and it's about leaving London, leaving England anyways, to come home, and the refrain is, tell my sister to tell my mother I'm coming home alone. Is this song based on a real story?
Yes, it is. Kate and Loudon, after they got married in 1971, moved to London, and she was expecting a baby. She lost the baby at about 5.5, 6 months.
When she was pregnant with it, yep. It was a miscarriage? Or?
Yeah, a miscarriage. Mm-hmm. And her marriage kind of fell apart at that point. I think Loudon decided he didn't really want to be married. And now that this had happened, anyway, so she did come home alone. And the other thing is, like, when Kate wanted to get out of a tight situation, because she was often, I'm not saying she was often in tight situations, she didn't like to disappoint people. So if she wanted to leave a job or something, she'd always say, "You're the oldest and more responsible one. You tell so-and-so that I can't do such and such." So I would be the one to do that. And then she would, you know, sort of scoot off and be free. But so in this way, she's saying, she doesn't want to tell my mother. So she says, "Tell my sister to tell my mother."
Well, this is a really beautiful song.
Yeah, it's...
So we'll hear Kate McGarrigle singing lead on Tell My Sister. And Anna, you sing some harmony on this.
Yes.
And Kate is also at the piano. This is Tell My Sister.
Weatherman on the radio threatens rain, maybe snow. He don't know I need blue sky. I've got a goal. I'm not a cowboy. I've never been shot. I'm not a convict. I've never been caught. Tell my sister to
the McGarrigle Sisters, Tell My Sister, a song written by the late Kate McGarrigle, who also sang lead on it and was featured on piano. My guest Anna McGarrigle singing harmony. And that's released on the new box set, Tell My Sister, which features the McGarrigle Sisters' first two albums and their first demos. Did singing together make you closer or create new conflicts as sisters?
Kate and I grew up, we were very, very close friends when we were growing up. But then when we became teenagers, we all sort of knew the same people, but we weren't together 24 hours a day. And in fact, at one point, I wanted to get my own apartment. This is after my father had died. And my mother said, "I want your sister to live with you because I want to go back to the country," because she was leaving Montreal. My mother was leaving Montreal, and I really didn't like the idea. I was so looking forward to having my own place, and then suddenly, oh, here we are, Kate and Anne again in the same apartment. But we were just so completely used to each other that, you know, new conflicts, sometimes we'd argue about how to do things or how to go about doing things. But, you know, I think down deep a lot of things didn't get done because... I don't know, we just move on to the next thing. You know, maybe sometimes we didn't solve all the problems.
My impression is there's probably a lot more drama in her life.
Certainly there was more drama at one point in her life, yeah.
Which point was that?
Well, when she split up with Loudon the first time, she was walking around with peritonitis for about 2 months, and she and I were doing a few gigs, and she was living at my mother's place up in Saint-Sever. And we went and did a couple of folk festivals together. And then it occurred to everybody that maybe she was sick. She'd lost a lot of weight. She was running a fever from time to time. And my mother said, let's go to my doctor. And anyway, so we went, and the doctor said, don't expect to have children, because she had, you know, blocked fallopian tubes or whatever. And she couldn't believe her ears, you know, that here she was now told she couldn't have any children. And it kind of broke her heart. So I think she just went out and tried to prove them all wrong, and she did. She came back and, you know, got back with Loudon, and suddenly she was pregnant again, this time with Rufus.
And she had two children, Rufus and Martha, who are both singers and songwriters.
Yeah.
Now, we heard this song, Tell My Sister, which was about Kate coming home from England. You wrote a song, a beautiful song, called Kitty Come Home, and Kitty was Kate's childhood nickname.
Yeah, a lot of people still called her Kitty.
Mm-hmm. So what's the story behind this song?
Well, this is written after she and Loudon split up for good, and she was kind of at loose end. She was living in New York City on 115th Street with the two children, and Loudon was living in the country house, and he had a girlfriend at the time. And my mother and I went down. We rented the biggest car we could rent, and we went down and we scooped her up and with the kids and all her belongings, and we moved back to Montreal temporarily, because I don't think she really wanted to stay here forever. And she rented an apartment, and my mother helped her a lot with the children. And she would find girls who were mother's helpers and that, because at this point we were already signed to Warner Brothers, and we're about to start in on our second record, Dancer with Bruised Knees. So anyway, I wrote Kitty Come Home because of that thing. I guess I was really angry.
Angry at?
angry at her husband for whatever reasons, you know. I mean, I don't know all the exact causes of their breakup, but I just felt terribly for her with the two young children, and it just kind of broke my heart. And I thought, well, come back here. At least people love you here.
It was a beautiful song, and it's a song by my guest Anna McGarrigle. We'll hear her singing lead and featured at the piano with Kate McGarrigle playing organ. McGarrigle singing her song Kitty Come Home with Kate McGarrigle featured on organ and a piano. And Kate died a year ago, January, and there's a concert in her memory that will be given May 12th and 13th in New York. The McGarrigle sisters' first two albums have just been reissued along with their first demo recordings. It's a 3-CD set, and it's called Tell My Sister. You know, we talked a little bit about how Kate had lived in several places and has some songs about coming and going And you read a passage from On the Road, Kerouac's On the Road, at her funeral. Was that a passage that she particularly loved?
You know, I don't know whether she liked that particular passage, but I think he talks about the dangled Doties, who are these, you know, the people that he's attracted to, the people, you know, who burn with a kind of artistic ambition and who are, you know, sort of kinetic energy. And I think of Kate as being that kind of person. If you met Kate on the street, you would want to know her because she had that kind of power, that aura about her. Anybody that met her never forgot her, and she made sure that you didn't forget her. She wanted to make an impression on people.
What about yourself?
You know, less so. I was not driven the same way. I'm a completely different animal.
You know, it's funny, she'd been married to Loudon Wainwright, and they had two children together, and, you know, had a difficult separation. And when you compare their songs are so different. Like, Kate's songs, not all of them, but so many of them are kind of, you know, sad and, you know, about lost love, broken relationships, a nostalgia for places or having to leave places. And so many of his songs, not all of them, but so many of his songs are kind of cynical or funny, clever. They're just like the tones of their songs are so different.
Yeah, and complementary in a lot of ways because, you know, if you put their songs together, you can there's a story there. And yes, Kate was an incurable romantic on one hand, but at the same time, she was also cynical about a lot of stuff, but not in her songwriting. Just I was going to say, maybe Loudon was a romantic too, but not in his songwriting.
Let's hear another song that was written by your sister Kate, and this is Mendocino, which is featured on the new box set. And this is a beautiful song. The funny thing is about that song is that she was asked to write a lyric for the New York State Department of Tourism.
I wrote about that on my blog. She wasn't asked. Somebody else asked me if they could rewrite the lyrics for an ad, and then I had to decline the pairing of her lyrics, you know, that would promote New York with Kate's melody because of something that had happened, a crazy thing, where Kate and I were arrested one night because she had two unpaid speeding tickets from 1990, and she couldn't believe it. Anyway, and they dragged us to a courthouse in the middle of the night, and she was very sick at this point. We were driving back from New York, but she was going fast. There's no doubt about it. But that isn't, I mean, we got stopped because she was driving fast. She drew attention to us in the little Mini that we were driving in, and the guy found these tickets on the computer when he was sitting in his car, and it was just a nightmare. They threw her in jail, you know, and we had to bail her out, and it was a very messy situation, and this was the New York State Trooper, and Kate had written this lovely song, you know, called Mendocino. They obviously didn't know anything about. Now somebody wanted to use it in an ad for New York, and I just said, because what, I can't remember what the lyrics were, but it was the exact opposite of what the song was about. So
what year was this?
What do you mean, when they asked? Mm-hmm. Just recently, just in the last year. It was after she died.
Wow.
They wanted to rewrite the lyrics. Somebody wanted to rewrite it. It wasn't the New York State. They hadn't asked. It was a woman who had wanted to use the tune of Mendocino and rewrite the lyrics to suit an ad for the state.
Right.
I mean, I have nothing against. She had nothing against New York State. It's just that I thought, in lieu of what had happened, I don't think she would have liked her song to have been cheapened by that.
Well, let's hear Kate McGarrigle's song, Mendocino, about leaving New York for California. And this is on the new collection of Kate and Anna McGarrigle's songs, Tell My Sister.
I bid farewell started roaming, and the trees grow high in New York State, and they shine like gold in autumn. Never had the blues from whence I came, but in New York State. Must I wait? Must I follow? Won't you say, come with me?
So that's Kate and Anna McGarrigle singing Kate's song Mendocino, with Kate singing lead, Anna singing harmony. And that's on the new reissue of Kate and Anna McGarrigle's first two albums, along with an album of their early demo recordings. So your sister Kate died in January of 2010. She had cancer. What kind of cancer was it?
She had something called clear cell sarcoma. But, you know, again, there's many sort of subtypes of that too. Anna was one that didn't react to... There was a drug out that was good if the tumor excreted something called a KIT factor, but her tumor didn't, so that drug wasn't good. So they used a more sort of broad spectrum kind of thing that was very, very strong, and it did sort of maybe keep the size of the tumors at bay, but it really messed up her hands and feet, and she had to go off the drugs because of something else that had happened, a radio ablation where they caught a bit of the intestine. And anyway, so, you know, I mean, it's brutal.
How did she deal with the fact that she was going to die? Because she probably, I assume she knew that.
Well, the thing is, you always, you know, you hope, you're always hoping that something is going to happen. And she was just incredibly brave. And also Kate was always the great escape artist, as I was saying. You know, she hated unpleasant situations. She had always managed to extricate herself from these things. But this is one that she couldn't get out of. And the only time she ever said anything was about a year and a half before she died. She said, "How come nobody asked me what it feels like to be dying?" And I said, "Well, frankly, you know, like, because we don't want to think about it." And maybe I was also very hopeful too, but she must have known something was terribly wrong, because she did become, I think, maybe she just sort of gave in a little more towards the end.
Did you take that as a cue that she wanted to talk about dying?
Yeah, we did talk about it. But then when she was actually dying, which would have been a year later, I said, "Tell me your deepest, darkest thoughts." And she said, "I'm not thinking about anything." And then shortly afterwards, she went into a coma.
Now, the whole family was there at the end.
Yeah.
And I read that you were all singing as she was in the coma.
We were all in her room. I hope she didn't mind that, you know. But everybody was singing and you know, holding her hand and rubbing her legs and forehead. And it was the first time I ever saw anybody die, and the first time for most people in that room.
How has your life changed without her?
For the first few months, I hunkered down. I went home to where I live in Eastern Ontario, because mostly I was afraid that I was going to go the same way, and I developed hyperthyroidism in a bad way. Which I'd been walking around with and didn't know I had, and then finally got it treated, and then I started to sort of come out of my shell a bit. But I still have a hard time walking around in Montreal, because everybody, we were always together, we did everything together. You know, when we were here, we shopped together, and you know, we were in the car together running errands. It's that much harder.
So Kate's children became singers, and Rufus and Martha Wainwright, and Rufus, of course, became you know, very well known. Were you surprised to see them become performers?
I wasn't surprised to see Rufus become a performer because Kate, I mean, she brought out the musician in him from a very early age, you know, and as did my mother. He always sang for her, you know, when he was 3 or 4 years old. And then he took piano lessons. So, and he was never shy either. And I think what happens is when kids grow up in a family where their parents are both performers and they do get to sort of get on stage, they're not afraid of the stage as much. And Martha, Kate used to worry that Martha couldn't carry a tune. And one night she and I snuck into a gig that Martha was doing with a band when she was 16 years old, because Martha was much more secretive about what she was doing. And I said, "You're crazy. Of course she can sing." She said, "Oh, I'm really worried that she can't." And so we we kind of skulked into this place and sat down in the dark. And then, of course, she came on and she sang 2 or 3 songs, and she was fantastic.
So were you afraid of the stage when you were younger?
Yes,
even when you were older?
I never liked the stage.
Because?
I don't know. Some people love it and some people don't love it. I mean, I know a lot of performers who are, you know, who get sick before they go on stage.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's close with another song that's been reissued on Tell My Sister. And I thought we would play Go Leave, which is another song that your sister Kate McGarrigle wrote. Would you tell us the story behind this song?
Well, I wasn't there when she was writing it, but I believe this has to do with, when Kate Loudon broke up the first time, and her last line is, "Hearts have a way of calling when they've been true." So there was a reconciliation, and the song, although terribly sad, has a happy ending, at least for the time being.
Are there any final thoughts you'd like to leave us with?
You know, I can't think of anything right now.
That's fine.
I just wish Kate could have been at these tribute concerts that are coming up. I mean, I was going to say the one strange thing about doing these songs for the concert is that the main girl isn't there. So in a way, I've been sort of filling in, playing her guitar part or her piano part or filling in for her voice. And it's a very strange feeling. But in a way, maybe when I'm singing her songs, maybe that's why I want to do music more, because I'm not singing my own songs, if that makes any sense to you. Maybe because she's speaking through me, who knows?
Well, Anna McGarrigle, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much. And again, I'm so sorry about your sister. I really appreciate your being with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Go leave. Better than me, or at least she is stronger. She will make it last longer. That's nice for you. Go leave, don't come back. No more am I for the taking, but I can't say that my heart's not aching. It's brave.
Anna McGarrigle will perform at tribute concerts in honor of her late sister Kate tomorrow and Friday night at Town Hall in New York. The new McGarrigle Sisters 3-CD set is called Tell My Sister. You'll find a link to a concert the McGarrigle Sisters performed in 2004 at Carnegie Hall on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new coming-of-age novel set at a high school for the performing arts. This is Fresh Air. Rachel Dawoskin's 2005 memoir, Foreign Babes in Beijing, took its title from the Chinese nighttime soap opera she starred in about Western women footloose in the capital city. Her new novel, Big Girl Small, explores an outsider trying to find her place in another kind of closed world, high school. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Don't read this novel if you have teenagers, or ever were a teenager, especially a teenage girl. It will bring back high school in raw, oozing detail, like a psychic's skin knee. The cliques, the whispers, the glossy girls, the frantic parties, the stupid drinking, the disconnected sexual encounters, and perhaps worst of all, the carnival of lost souls that is the lunchtime cafeteria. High school. A world so hostile to the outsider that even a Navy SEAL might hesitate at the threshold. There's one compelling reason, however, to ignore my warnings about Rachel Dawoskin's new novel, Big Girl Small, the voice of her narrator, Judy Loden. Judy is 16, a sarcastic, smart, gutsy, and thoughtful incarnation of 16 that any parent would be reassured by. In addition to her other strengths, Judy also possesses a Susan Boyle-sized voice, so her loving parents, who own a diner in Ann Arbor, Michigan, scrape up the money to transfer her to the Darcy Arts Academy, a private school for the performing arts. Here's Judy's description of walking into Darcy that first day. The halls were bulging with kids hugging each other, throwing books into their lockers, slinging on fashionable backpacks, singing, leaping. It was like that old movie, Fame. I felt sick, tried to focus on the student murals my parents had pretended to admire. The lockers are all painted by students, too. It's a big competition, of course, and there are stories of the most famous lockers ever, like Sophie Armoria's. She graduated 10 years ago, but people still reminisce about how she painted herself naked on her locker in thick, glistening oil so that the combination dial was one of her nipples. The complication here is that Judy is a little person, all of 3 feet 9 inches tall. In the novel, Judy's size functions as both reality and metaphor. Practically speaking, being a dwarf affects Judy's every social encounter and makes the whole high school ordeal harder. For the average-sized reader, however, Judy's size is an intensified version of the alienation that all of us who were marked as different by accent, class, weight, acne, sexual preference, shyness, you name it, can remember. Things seem to go surprisingly well for Judy during her first months at Darcy. She bonds with a couple of other outsider girls, Molly, one of the few African-Americans at the school, and goth Sarah, whose dyed oily black hair and piercings, Judy describes her as looking riddled by bullets, mask a sweet personality. Judy lands a showcase part in the fall show and even picks up a boyfriend of sorts, Kyle, a standard-sized hottie. Maybe her parents' anxious hope that she'll become popular with the rest of the kids, or as Judy Riley puts it, become a beloved Lilliputian among the Brobdingnagians, has actually come true. But sadly, we readers know it ain't so. We know because Judy is telling us her story retrospectively, in hiding, from a dump called the Motel Manor on the edge of town. The press is looking for her, and so are her parents and friends. Something really, really horrible happened to Judy at Darcy Arts Academy, something that makes this novel's acknowledged forerunner, Stephen King's Carrie, read like a mere drop in the bloody bucket of teen humiliation. Big Girl Small is not flawless. Just as Judy can't imagine a life beyond her current miserable state of suspended animation at the Motel Manor, Dawoskin can't seem to figure out how to give her novel an ending that's of a piece with Judy's harsh experiences and her resilient response to them. The ending that Dawoskin supplies here is too pat. But apart from that disappointment, Big Girl Small is a distinctive addition to the already packed cosmic library of coming-of-age stories. As Dawoskin's novel wistfully reminds us, the destruction of innocence plot never gets worn out, because the ways in which innocence can be destroyed are apparently infinite.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Big Girl Small by Rachel Dawoskin. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. I'm Terry Gross.